Johnny Vellacott Real 4.
Right, well, we were down near the bomb dump, loading up these bombs. As I say, you put a bomb between your knees, you take off the nose cap, you insert the detonator, which is full made of mercury, and you don't hang it around with it in your hand, because that goes, a full of mercury detonator goes off with temperature. You put it in the bomb, spin down the nose cap and put the safety pin in. Pick up the bomb and lay it down on the grass. That it's safe there. And they lay them down in a row. Well, I was sitting on a box of bombs with various bombs around and detonators, and I was back to back with the armourer. And the other lads were strewn around, all busy working, doing this, you see. And all of a sudden, it was quiet. And I, of course, the first thing I did was to look up. I thought we were about to be attacked, you know. There was not a thing in the sky, you see. So I said to the armourer, "What's wrong?" He didn't answer me. So I said, "What's happening?" He didn't answer me. And I noticed there was nobody there but us two. So I turned round, and I could see he was frozen. He got a handful of detonators. He got one between each finger. And he was being clever. He had four bombs in his lap. He was doing one, two, three, four, like that, you see, leaving the detonator slide out of his fingers. Well, the first one, first detonator he went to use, he dropped it. And instinctively grabbed at it to catch it. And thank heavens, he caught it soft on the heel of his hand. But realizing what he had done, he froze. He couldn't move. And all the other lads saw this, and they jumped down into the wadi, you see. Because nobody shouted duck or anything like that. So it wasn't until I saw this that I realized the score. Well, now, I didn't know quite how long he'd had these in his hand. But I knew that, as I said before, temperature sets them off. So I quickly grabbed his hand and I forced his fingers open one at a time and took a detonator and put it down on the grass until I got them all out of his hand. And it was quiet. Nobody worried. So then the heads started to appear up over the edge, because time had gone by when if anything was going to happen, it would have happened. And they said, "What's happening?" I said, "Just say if you can come up, you scoundrels." So they came up. They said, what happened?" So I told them, I said, "That man's a maniac. I mean, I know familiarity breeds contempt. That was a damn silly thing to do." So anyhow, they took him away. I didn't see him anymore for the rest of the day. He was petrified. His face was something to behold, honestly. But anyhow.
But that's at Panathinaikos, you said, in Greece.
Yes.
Coming back to Crete. You were saying you did these operations in support of the Navy.
Yes.
Were you attacked by the enemy whilst you were on those operations?
Not very often, actually. Mostly, it was friendly fire from the Navy. It's not really funny, but nevertheless. But the fact of our presence being there was sufficient to make things easier. See, a 109... had to come a long way before he could get to the convoy, and he didn't have the endurance that we had, and we were nearer to the convoy. So that being the case, you know, we were better off. But, sorry, go on.
No, you carry on, please.
That being the case, we flew a lot. We were in the air all the time. And I got stood down one day because, you know, we'd been flying so hard. And they put me on to supervise the ration run. I had to go down to Hania in a lorry and supervise the loading of the supplies, which was nothing to do with me. I didn't have anything to do with it, actually. It was only an excuse for me to get away, obviously. Anyhow, that's another story. But the flight sergeant engineering in charge of A-Flight was the flight sergeant Frid. He was built like a brick wall, solid, and he was one of the nicest men. Once you knew him, Freddy was one of the nicest men you could wish for. And in fact, latterly, he gave his life to save other people. He was a hero. No two ways about that, but that's another story.
How did he give his life to save other people?
He let them get away whilst he covered a hand grenade. They were in a slit trench, and the Jerry threw a hand grenade in. And he was wounded, But before they could do it again, he told the other boys to run for it, and he'd give them covering fire. And I should think that he must have died of wounds. But anyhow, each year, when I go out on the pilgrimage with the Crete veterans, I go to his grave. It's the third row back from the front, the second grave in.
And what was his name?
Frid, F-R-I-D-D. And he was a wonderful man, as I say. He gave his life to help others. And, well, he really was a hero, but I don't think he got any decoration or anything. Well, there's only one fella got a decoration for all of that. He was our medic man. And there's a man lying wounded out in the middle of the drome. And he was in the middle of crossfire. How it missed him each time, nobody seemed to know, but he was lying there wounded. And our medic, with another man, went out to him and brought him back. And he got wounded himself twice in the doing of it. And he was put up for the military medal. And the other fellow with him was also put up for the military medal. Now, he survived, and I've seen him since. He sometimes used to come to the squadron reunions. But the other lad didn't. And because he didn't survive, he didn't get the medal.
What was the name of the one who survived?
Oh.
Well, it doesn't matter if you can't remember.
I can't remember offhand.
Where were you at the time?
Flying, I believe. Anyhow, things were bad, and apparently when they were staffing the... By this time I had left. That's right. By this time I'd left and gone to Egypt, but they were staffing the drome, and because there was a Junker 52 came in, and every time any aircraft came in, our lads opened fire on them with German machine guns, you see, and they were not very happy about this, so the 109 should come back and staff the area, you see. Anyhow, this Junker 52 came in, and it is considered that the man who got out of it was recognised, and he was student. You may have heard of student, the man in charge of the paratroopers. Anyhow, he got out, and he walked around the aircraft and looked around, and nobody shot him unhappily. He got back into the aircraft and flew back to Athens and said, oh, we can capture Crete, it's easy. And that was why the paratroopers came in. Well, now, whilst they were coming in, the 109s were staffing, we had three Bofors guns defending the aerodrome, one either end and one in the middle. And apparently, things were really hectic for the gunners on the Bofors. And there was one down the western end, and an aircraft came in, and it was a Hurricane, wheels down to land, flaps down. And he saw this coming in. It looked so much like a 109. He was sitting on his gun metal muzzle, right on the gun muzzle, as you might say, on open sights, all done on open sights. And he blasted him. He blew him out of the sky. When somebody told him it was a hurricane, he broke down. And he wept. He realised what he'd done. Anyhow, that's one of the sad instances.
And that was at Malmö.
Yes.
Do you think that story of the visit of general students is correct?
Yes. And had there been a sniper to hand, he could have either shot student or punctured the tires of the aircraft so that it couldn't take off, or both. And student would not have gone back to Athens to say, it's easy, all we need to do is send paratroopers in. Because, as you know, he was a big paratroop man. Well, they're not all bad stories came out of it. Because one of our boys, but as you probably know, all tents were dug in. That is, inside, they were dug down to a given depth. Normally, so that if you were lying down there, any shrapnel or bullets would go over the top of you. But the tent was so arranged that the hole was slightly smaller by probably about, 9 inches all round, like a shelf. and it was used as a shelf. And one of the boys had just got a letter from home. Goodness only knows how it came through, because he didn't get mail for months. And he's reading this, and he had, you know, the writing cases you used to get like that, but with a zip all the way around, and they could open like a book.
This is like my recorder case.
Yeah. And, well, anyhow, he had his notebook open, his letter there, and he was two or three other things. He was reading it, you see. And the alarm went, so he dropped everything and ran to his, you know, position. And he never got back. He never got back to his tent. After the war, quite a little while after the war, he received a parcel from Germany. And in it was his writing case, etc. A German paratrooper had picked it up, carried it in his knapsack. When he got home, he kept it. After the war, he sent it back to the owner. That, in my book, is damn good. Which only goes to prove once again, they weren't all baddens, you know. They were just doing the job that they were sent to do. But, well, there were one or two baddens, of course. There were some terrible things done. But that, I think, is worth recording. I thought that was very good. But, well, eventually, they held the aerodrome by day. We held the aerodrome at night. And apparently, they put a machine gun in, they built an emplacement facing the roadblock, facing the road coming from Hania. And anybody who ventured on that road was blasted with machine gun fire. And things were pretty bad, and nobody could move until the Maoris decided it was time for movement. So they jumped out into the road and did the haka. And the Jerrys took to their tails and ran. They didn't even take the gun with them. They were frightened to death. Well, now, I'm sure you're aware that the haka does look a bit formidable. Anyhow, we thought this was a high point. Everybody was tickled to death about this.
Did you see the haka?
No. I wasn't there then. But it was absolutely wonderful, I'm given to understand. And that was a terrific boost to everybody. Of course, the old New Zealanders, I mean, they were tickled to death with this. And there was a large New Zealand contingent there. And in fact, it was mostly New Zealanders and our ground staff from the squadron that defended Malamy, mostly. A few odd ones from different units who got separated from their units, etc. And they joined in. And, of course, there were the Cretans, the local Cretans. And there was their police force. Some of their police force, they were mustered by the chief of police, and they did their stuff to defend the area. And they bought that island very expensively. And they lost twice as many as men as we did. Their losses were 100% greater than ours. And they say that when Student was seen by somebody after Crete, he was drawn. His face was drawn and haggard, and he looked as if he'd aged 10 or 15 years. Because that was his baby, the invasion of Crete. And it was far, far too expensive in man and equipment. And a point arises here, which is not generally known, but is very important strategically, etc. It was one of the biggest points in the whole of the war. They lost so many men, key men, elite, took corps, etc. So many machines, Junker 52s and the others, and gliders, etc. They lost so many that back in Berlin, they found they didn't have the force to invade Russia. So it was delayed 6 weeks whilst they mustered them. And those 6 weeks led to the winter. That was why the attack on Russia failed. And although, as I say, it's not generally known, that all pivoted on the Battle of Crete.
Can we pick up your narrative where I broke you off at the Wadi Natron?
Yes. Oh, well, I was then I was transferred to 55 Squadron, and we had no aircraft because 55 had lost all their aircraft up the desert. So all we had was tents out in the middle of nowhere alongside the main road between Alex and Cairo. And so we were just lost without anything to do there, you see. Then presently, the CO got a Lysander, and he used it as a taxi. So if he was sent for to go to HQ or me, he used to fly up to Heliopolis, then get a taxi into HQ or me, you see. On occasions other than that, he would be sent for to go down to Alexandria to contact with the Navy and liaise with them, you see. Well, this is all very well, but after all, when he went to HQME, his in his Lysander, there's nobody at Cairo. We thought that was a poor thing. So the sergeant in charge of transport, the sergeant in charge of catering, my wicked maid Taft Davis and I used to pinch the CO's car and hightail it up the other direction, you see. And we'd have a little do up there and come back again. Of course, this was all very unknown, like, you see. And then if the old man went in the opposite direction, we went in the opposite direction to him, you see. And one afternoon in Alex, we realised we were very dangerously put, because obviously we'd gone there in Katie shorts and shirt and a topi. And as you know, after a given time, you have to change into long sleeves, trousers, you know, slacks, and a side hat, not a topi. And we noticed some people were walking around dressed for the evening. So we thought, uh-oh, time to go. So we got back in the old man's car and drove back to Wadi Natroon, you see. Nobody knows nothing, as you might say. But it was a little bit of a near call, actually. But anyhow, after a while, old Jack Stinchmore was a particular mate of mine. He and I, we went into Alexandria, and we went to the Roxy nightclub, which we had frequented previously. And we knew some of the gals there, some of the entertainers. But there was one particular lady, I would say she's probably about a year or maybe 2 years older than the general girl on the dance floor. And she was a friend of ours. She always used to say hello and come over and sit with us. But she'd only ever take one drink. That's all. So she had one glass of champagne. But for that, for every glass of champagne or whatever they had, they were given a little disc. And this, at the end of the evening, they cashed in with the governor, and that gave them a certain percentage back. That's why they hopped from twig to twig, collecting discs as fast as they could. But our lady wouldn't accept any more than just the one. And we sat there, and she said, "You've just come back from Greece, haven't you?" So we said, "Now, you know very well we're not allowed to talk about that sort of thing." She said, "You don't have to tell me. Look at you. You've lost weight, you're drawn, you're haggard, you're pale, you look as if you're half dead. And Greece has just happened."
Was she English?
No, I think she's probably continental, I should say. Probably, one of the Central European states there. Anyhow, that's neither here nor there. But, you see, we didn't realise this. It was obvious. Any onlooker could have told. And she did, but she told us in time, so to speak. And it was then that we realised that it had been a bit of a hard campaign. And, as I say, we'd lost weight, and we were haggard and drawn, you know. So, anyhow, that was a little incident there. And then back to the squadron, 55 Squadron again. And later...
Did you think that these girls in these nightclubs might be spying?
Oh, some of them were, no question. Anyhow, back to Cairo. One of the boys was in the long bar there. And that's a place for imbibing refreshments, as one might say. And there were two or three of them there. And somebody came along and clapped them on the shoulder and said, "Hello, boys, how are we then?" Who was it? Johnny London from Greece, dressed in the uniform of a captain of the intelligence corps. Like I said, you didn't know who you were talking to over there. What he did, apparently, when the time to go arrived, he gave whatever money he had to his girls and picked up his books and chattels and went down to the docks, showed his papers and said, I want to get out. So out he was brought. Of course, he went to HQME and was debriefed, and he had a lot of information to impart, of course. Well, that's what happened to Johnny London. And I do hope that he survived the war, because he was a very nice bloke, and he was definitely on our side. But that's another story as well. Shall we pause while I'd have a drink of water, please? Right, well, 55 Squadron eventually moved to Helwan to collect aircraft, which they did. And they were Blenheim 5s. No, Blenheim 4s, rather, which was the long-nose Blenheim. Whereas on my squadron, it was the short-nose Blenheim. Now, the long-nose Blenheim had a greater range than the short, but they reckoned that the short-nose Blenheim was 20 miles an hour faster. But whether that's the ability of the pilot or not, I don't know. But the long-nose Blenheim, it had an advantage over us because it had a greater boost, I think. Ours was only 2.5, but they could have +9. This was arrived at by a lever on the dashboard. And if they were being pursued and things were getting too hot, they pulled down the +9 lever, and that gave them +9 boost, and away they went. Now, that was known amongst us all as the Igory stick, Igory being Arabic for hurry up, like. And that was known as the Igory stick. And if things got nasty, turn down that blasted Igory stick. But that's another story. Anyhow, we were told we were going to do anti-shipping strikes. Well, what exactly does that entail? Oh, well, we'll tell you more about it later on, but that's the story. Now, there's two poles set up with a small white pyramid between them out at so-and-so, which was virtually a bombing range. The idea is that that represents a ship, the two masts, and the centrepiece, white pyramid there, that is the, well, it's the wheelhouse, presumably. So we said, all right, well, what's the score? They said, you are to circle it. And then at a given moment, you're attack, not necessarily from the beam, but from any angle, and you will fly in below the level of the mass and any aerials there may be, drop your bomb through the side of the ship like a torpedo and get yourself away. And the gunner will strafe the decks to prevent any clever Charlie getting his machine gun firing at us. But we thought this was a bit dangerous. Anyhow, we had a try at it and so on, so then they decided to do a live bombing drop on a rock out at sea. It wasn't an island, it was only a bare rock. So, well, we need bombs for this. So, Lord only knows where they got these bombs. They were so old-fashioned. They must have been 1418 bombs. But they had funny-shaped fins on them, and, oh, they weren't tidily streamlined like our bombs of the day and so on. They were chunky. Anyhow, they were put in the bomb racks and off they went, you see. Well, happily, it wasn't my turn. And off they went, and they went towards the target, and the gunner said it was something to see. They dropped this bomb, and it went into the water, the tail fin shot off, and the bomb started to bounce. And it was bouncing along, following the aircraft, bouncing higher than the aircraft, and looking highly dangerous. And they didn't think much of that either. So that was discontinued. Then one morning there was an urgent call, and the Sea Oak and his crew took off, and off out to sea they went. So nobody knew what was happening because it had been so quick. Well, what's happening? Well, the old man's gone out, and I think it's either a U-boat or a ship out there carrying arms. Oh, well, I wonder how they get on. So anyhow, a signal came back from them. Please say 3 late breakfast. You see, so I thought, oh, wacko, they're all right, you see. Never seen or heard again. They just disappeared without any indication of any sort, whether they flew in, whether they were attacked, or what, nobody knows. But you see, if they attacked a ship and the ship had a gun to fire back at them, it might have just blown them out of the sky, who knows. But they were never heard of again after that. Anyhow, round about that time, I decided I was 2 years overdue for coming home.
But had you taken part in any anti-shipping strikes yourself?
Happily, no, thank you very much. I'd done a convoy escort and so on from Edcou, which is our base there, but didn't get involved with anything. Anyhow, I decided it was time I went home. And so there was another fellow there, similar vintage, and I mentioned it to him. He said, well, funny you should say that, but I'm 2 years overdue as well. Ah, he said, now I've got a clue. I have heard, I do like that expression, I have heard that some rifles go back to HME, 365 of them. It's easy to remember, it's days in the year. So I said, oh yes. He said, well, they cannot go without senior NCOs who are armed to escort them. I said, yes. He said, we could fit the bill, couldn't we? I said, yes. He said, let's go to the adjutant. So we went and saw the adjutant, and he said, you boys are rather well informed, but you're quite correct. You better get your small kit ready, because the takeoff is at dawn in the morning in a lorry that's going to take you all the way, and it's going to be hard going. That bit, I think, he said with relish. But that's something else. Anyhow, sure as fate, off we went the following morning, you see. We went down Palestine, across the Sinai, over the Suez, and over to HME at Cairo. And the rifles were left there. We didn't see them anymore. Our duties were done. So then old Timber Woods said to me, now, we have a little duty to perform, haven't we? I said, oh yes, rather. Now, he must have been into HQME a number of times previously, because it was a rabbit warren of passages and corridors and rooms and things. So he said, come with me, I'll show you. So we went along a long corridor, and at the end, I remember it must have been the last door on the left. It was on the left. And on the door it said, keep out, this means you. So we promptly went in, and there was a sergeant behind a desk there. Well, it was not a desk, it was a table 6 feet airman, as they say. It was a trestle table, obviously, covered with papers. And he looked up with a bit of a smile happening. He said, I wonder what you two want, as if I didn't know. Where are you? So we told him. He said, what's your names? So we told him, we're on the second page down. Oh, we thought, that's rather tiddly. So he said, all right, go back to your unit, and I'll let your adjutant know. And you're on the boat. Do you know, he knew before we got back. We waltzed in the following morning. He said, yeah, I know, you're going home, you don't have to tell me. That's why you went down, didn't you? So he said, yes. A couple of crafty herbers. So anyhow, we were on the boat, as they say, due to go home, see. We were on the boat. So we went down. Terrible place on the southern end of the Suez Canal there, and
Port Suez.
Oh no, out in the desert, opposite 107 maintenance unit. Oh, I remember the number, 107 maintenance unit. Anyhow, Kasfarit, that was the name of it. KAS. Farite, I think it was. Anyhow, it was a tent establishment, so we lived in tents there, you see. And the mess was a marquee, of course, and so on. And our tents were all dug in. We didn't have any bother like that. Didn't have to dig our own tents in. So I used to go down to the mess sometimes just before lunch, just before tiffin, as it was then, to get food, you see. And as I went past a certain tent,